1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, improvement, lean, service design, and sales and marketing. The podcast is sponsored by the Lean Marketing Lab, a learning community dedicated to developing and improving the user experience. Now, to the podcast.
Welcome, everyone. This is Joe Dagher, the host of the Business 901 podcast. With me today is Kim Robertson. Kim is an associate of Value Transformations and co-author of a soon-to-be-released book on configuration management, theory, practice, and application. He started his first company at the age of 18 and has an extensive background spanning 40 years in all aspects of business and aerospace. Configuration management is supposed to help us with all this, all these problems, and to me, it sounds good, but how does configuration management, what are the keys there to make all these things right, as we just talked about?
If you look for them in ISO or an EIA standards, you'll find some definitions that came out from the military and were developed that way. Lots of the people on the EIA standards I know personally, and they work for companies like Boeing, which have large government contracts and that sort of thing. Basically, if you want to understand what configuration management is, you have to go back to the beginnings. At one time, say with Leonardo da Vinci, he could make a painting or a sketch, and any qualified person, be it a wheelwright or whatever, would be able to look at that, understand it, and say, oh, okay, you need an 18-foot diameter wheel. I can make you one of those. And they were all built on a similar pattern. Today, things are so specialized that you don't have a core group of people like the guilds used to be that are controlling things. You have your design is now split up between so many design functions that there is nobody looking at the entire configuration and how it interplays. This is really important with some of the software development, where you may take certain functions of the software, develop them in their own developmental stream, and then reintegrate them back into the whole. But if you're not keeping communications open, which is the information management or the management of the data associated with the product you're developing, when they go to reintegrate into the main software, it's moved off someplace else, and they find they spent months developing the wrong thing. I remember at one company, they were producing vehicles to work at Vandenberg Air Force Base, and because there was a fly spec or a little piece of whiteout, if you will, on the copier, when the copy of the spec was made and sent to the design department, it said that it had to filter out 3.6 times 10 to the third microns. Well, it came out minus 3 microns. So they were actually getting down to where they were trying to design a filter for this Volvo white truck that would filter out cigarette smoke. You have to ask questions. You have to make sure that everything is understood, and you can't do that all the time with net meetings or what we call a transactional environment with texting or emails. Actually, you have to sit down face-to-face occasionally and have a synergy of discussions and pick up on the body language and ask questions and work things out that way. It happens very well in some companies. Take the Bugatti Veyron that was produced by Volkswagen. It is a marvelous machine. The fastest production luxury car there is. It goes faster than the Formula One cars, but it comes with air conditioning, leather seats, seats five, you know, all that type of stuff. And then we try and compare that to something that isn't produced with the same type of integration of information exchange or management of the data exchange. And you end up with things like the exploding Pinto, you know. If you're not talking, then things are going to go awry, and CM and data management, part of configuration management, can help with that. As I said earlier, keeping things organized so the creatives can do things and understand what it is they're doing is probably the biggest goal of configuration management, and everybody does it. It used to be that there was one department called configuration management, and information technology, systems engineering, and all that were part of it. As these have grown due to complexity of the programs and products that we're making, so have the data integration needs. And the book that we wrote tries to circle around and say, okay, you've all got your own charters, but you're all doing part of the what used to be considered the configuration and data management job. You might have people in the quality organization looking at things and saying, okay, what's the disposition of this item? Is it used as is? Is it scrap? Is it rework or something like that? Well, that has to go back into the configuration process somehow. I'm not sure if it still happens, but International Harvester, for example, with every vehicle, you used to end up with a parts list of the parts that were actually used on that vehicle because you have authorized part substitutions. And then you have program authorized part substitutions. So if you don't keep track of even those, you won't know what the final configuration is. And if something goes wrong, you won't know if it's limited to the units that had a particular configuration or all units. You don't have the granularity built into the system.
You quoted some things about traceability and food and the data configuration, the data trail for traceability. When I saw that, it was like, that's not, you know, here we are talking, you know, basically from field to fork. Is there a data path even in that supply chain from the farmer to the consumer that we can find?
Yes, very much so. You may have remembered the wisteria issues they had with the Rocky Ford cantaloupes grown here in Colorado that were distributed nationwide. The fact that the wisteria was found in the soil where these were grown, and the company voluntarily destroyed all of their crops and sanitized their land for the wisteria contaminant and went from there. But we have standards that are international now dealing with the quality of how food is prepared, how we move it from location to location, and it does more than just the Food and Drug Administration checking to see if your processing plant is okay. It also carries from the time the item is produced to the end of shelf life and how to disposition some of these things. When we move from the alkaloid type batteries to the NiCad batteries and to the mercury batteries, disposition at the end of the flow became even more critical. Your CFL light bulbs are another example of that, moving from incandescent to CFLs. So we, at this point, international regs as well as U.S. federal regs control a lot of what data has to be gathered, what has to be tracked through to end disposition.
My point to my question is that we just talked about how much time we spent looking for data and a success rate, and then we go back to how much inaccuracies are within the data that when we actually find it. And we talk about the lack of data cross-references. You know, these are title headings or subchapter headings in your book. You know, inadequate data safeguards and stuff. And then we look at a supply chain with numerous handoffs, okay? I mean, going all the way through the system and stuff. And can I believe the data?
It depends how it's organized. The biggest problem that we have with most data is there isn't a single source of truth in the enterprise. We go back to the filing cabinets. You know, in my filing cabinet, I have the first revision of a specification because that's the part I worked on. I hand it off to somebody else. They have a second one, but it has the same date on. the two items are not the same, even though they have the same date on them. There's not a single source of truth. Within the data systems that we have to be able to implement in order to survive in a world marketplace, let alone assure the safety of the people who consume our products, we need to get much better with that sort of thing. One of the things that's helped that is some of the products that we have with databases, if they are a controlled source with some sort of revision control or change control, where you check something out, work on it, check it back in, and it has a different version number, that certainly helps. The other thing that we need to do is to look at the world around us and say, how is this data going to be used? And that isn't as easy as it sounds. You can take a look at any product that has been developed, and as soon as it hits the market, people find new uses for it. Who would have envisioned, for example, that the iPhone would now be capable of taking and processing multiple pictures to make a 3D object that could then be ported over to something like a 3D printer for printing a replica of, say, an antique coin where the original is so valuable that no one dare touch it because it's old and is fragile and it might break. But if they make a replica out of it in a plastic or even in metal, then you have something people can actually study, find out how it was manufactured. And this leads us to some recent developments in the museum world. The Smithsonian has started a 3D scanning project to scan every one of its assets. This is being picked up by other museums that are taking not only 3D scans, but MRIs and combining them with the combination of that and what we have with something like the ability to print in 3D, which China is now printing working kidneys that would be acceptable the size of a dog's kidney, with the eventual goal of getting everybody off of the waiting lists for these products. How do you control that? And we have the capability, or will have very soon, to replicate most of the human organs. So what do we do? Is the printer certified to a certain level? What happens if this design is printed on a machine that isn't recently certified and there's anomalies built into it that could be life-threatening? And this is taking it to the extreme. But these issues are before us right now, and we need to take a look at how it might be used, not just how do you plan to use it, as far as the data that you're collecting and what hooks you put into the system itself.
With our configuration management, we have to be somewhat predictive.
Yes, you can take a look, for example, at any one of the satellites that's been orbited by our space-capable nations. And I'll just take the ISAT satellite, which was built primarily to measure the deterioration of the thickness of the ice at the polar caps. Well, all of a sudden they found that if you have this technology, you could measure the amount of deforestation going on in the rainforest, because it took a laser bounce off of whatever the tallest object was, and then the next year it would measure again and see if anything had changed. Well, that's very good for ice, where you're talking about inches, but it's even better for things like rainforest, where you're talking about hundreds of feet of difference in elevation just because of deforestation. So when you look at these things, you have to be a little bit farsighted and maybe science fiction-y, if you will, and say, okay, based upon what we know today, what can we extrapolate this might be used for in the future, and how do we put those data hooks in the system?
So are we saying that configuration management needs to be used by everyone, that everyone, department leader, let's say, and even maybe down to the individual, has to sit back and kind of organize, lack of a better word, his own desktop computer in some type of configuration and have that consistency throughout an organization or department that needs to take place?
Yes, there should be department-wide, because otherwise you have stovepipe center of excellence for the data retention or data management, if you will. If you don't have a consistency of how you organize your data and how you label your data, then you're not going to be able to have any consistency in how you go later and find that data. For example, lots of people, even on a server or file server, will put the date and time of the object. So they might say 01-10-2015. Well, when that gets into the server and it sorts on ASCII format, it's going to end up putting all the January data together regardless of year. So if you haven't got a taxonomy set up for the data structure you're going to be having for your enterprise that says, okay, for all these files, we'll put the year in four digits first, then your data is not going to sort properly, and you're going to end up having to do a secondary shred through the data to find out what you're looking for. Ideally, you'd be able to go into a system and say, okay, I know that Joe created this report dealing on a trade show that he went to in 1997. I don't remember the name of the trade show, and I don't remember
what the subject was.
But we should be able to find it in the system. Well, if you haven't built the hooks in up front and don't have a consistent way of labeling things, you're going to end up with a search that's not effective at all. And 50% of the searches result in data, and out of those, 30% result in data that may be usable. So once you start doing these types of things, you really up the ability to find information. You drive those curves down dramatically. This is an enterprise-wide effort. This is enterprise data management, if you will.
How does metadata play into all this discussion, okay? I mean, can you give me a short description of what's going to happen with metadata in the future, maybe, or what should we be on the lookout for?
Metadata itself, metadata is data about data. So, for example, I may be working on a program for customer A. I have engineering drawings, I have engineering analyses, and all that type of stuff. You may end up in your database with a metadata field saying what the company name is or what the contract number is. You could later sort and say, okay, we know that the data was for this company. Can it be reused for somebody else? And without that data identification, you may never be able to research that. For example, you may have a specialty type of a steering mechanism on a vehicle, and the vehicle was short-lived because the market wasn't ready for it. For example, all-wheel drive. The first attempts at all-wheel drive were very successful as far as the vehicles went, but they were not very successful as far as the market went. Now you find all-wheel drive every place. Had that data not been properly marked so that it could be retrieved, you would have had to go back to the drawing board spending millions of dollars to regenerate the technologies, instead of simply leveraging them forward.
A lot of people look at controlling their own data, that they want control of it because it's part of their generating it. They have ownership in it. Is that ever really going to be feasible?
It depends on how you define that thing that you're trying to control. So I'll give you an example. I have intellectual property that I feel is mine, which may be photographs of family. It may be the types of things that you would share with people on your Christmas card and that sort of thing. If you are putting that information on Facebook, for example, I believe the clause is still in the Facebook user agreement that as soon as you post something, Facebook can use that information any way they want to, including sell it to somebody else. So once you do that and sign up for that agreement, you have lost control of your personal IP. When it comes to things like patented technologies and trademark type technologies, countries have different ways of looking at it. For example, some companies say, we don't care who built this IC chip. We'll give a patent to every new application for it. So if you originally built it for a cell phone and now all of a sudden somebody has it, saying, oh, well, geez, we'll use that same technology for your garage door opener so you can open your garage door from your cell phone, that would be two patents. So once we get to some sort of international standard for what that IP means worldwide, it's going to be a lot easier to protect it. Right now, you'll find it's kind of anybody's game, but it has been for years. Back in antiquity, for example, intellectual property and data encryption took different forms. There's historical records of this fellow who wanted to get information about a city out to the people that were going to invade the city. And so he had some trusted servants, and he shaved their heads, and he tattooed the instructions on their heads and let their hair grow and sent them out. Well, it's a very early form of IT security. In Sumner, they used to have little clay balls that they put tokens inside, and the token may be, here's three measures of wheat, two measures of metal, and four measures of beer. And once those were put inside the clay ball and both people's seals were put on it, that was a binding protected piece of IP until that clay ball, which was known as a boule, was broken. And then you could say, oh, okay, you're Fred. Yeah, you've worked for me a week, so here I'm going to pay you your metal and your wheat and your beer. The idea that all of this is new is not true. It's just become more critical as we've reached the population densities that we have. It was much easier to control when your nearest neighbor was 20 miles away. Now that your nearest neighbor is nanoseconds away, in the electronic world, it gets very hard to control. I don't think we're ever going to really get there. I think that we're making great strides, but a lot of that is based upon trust. And some of the problems we find is based upon different definitions of what IP really is. For example, in the U.S., we say we patented this design wherever you use it. In Japan, they say we patent this usage of that design wherever it is. So, of course, there's going to be disconnects until we come to a common language.
What's the best way for someone to contact you and learn more about the book, upcoming book?
They could contact me through the Value Transformations website. I can give you that kim@valuetransform.com. That's valuetransform.com.
They can contact you on LinkedIn also, correct?
Yes, I'm also on LinkedIn. Feel free to contact me. I'm available to answer most questions. I was just helping somebody earlier this morning with questions about what type of product lifecycle management systems there are out there and if there's a preference for one versus the other.
When is the book scheduled to publish?
The book is available now on Amazon.com. And distribution will start in May.
Well, I would like to thank you very much, Kim. I appreciate it. This podcast will be available in the Business 901 iTunes Store and the Business 901 website. So thanks again, Kim.
Thank you, sir.
Visit us at theleanmarketinglab.com.